Well, Angelo, I think it's fair to say that you have given us not Gallo Red, but Chateau Lafite Rothschild 69, which is a hell of a year. Our next speaker will follow on what Dr. Cortavilla has given us, and that is, you know, what do we guide ourselves by? What do we have beyond custom and history and tradition? Well, we have documents. Particularly, we in the United States are blessed to have the Constitution. And Dr. Herman Belz, who is a professor of history at the University of Maryland, this is his specialty. Number of books and publications, fellowships and scholarships from the American Bar Association, the American Historical Association, graduate of Princeton, received his doctoral degree from the University of Washington. And it's so important that we understand exactly the role of the Constitution and what it means and how it should be adhered to as we make what really are life and death decisions these days. Dr. Belz.
Thank you very much, Dr. Edwards. My friends at the University of Maryland, which is one of those multicultural institutions that about which you heard last night, my friends at Maryland have, of course, never heard of the Philadelphia Society, but they think it has a nice, friendly image to it. It sounds nice. I usually let it go at that without getting into too much detail about the society. This is a very spirited group. I'm always happy to come here. I'm a relatively new member. I'm learning at each meeting more about the mores and a little bit about the rules of the institution and the organization, and I greatly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you here today. School children killing other children in public schools is not obviously a constitutional problem. It is a moral problem. It is to be more precise, a social and cultural demoralization problem. An American president taking the country into war is a constitutional problem. It is the kind of constitutional problem that the United States Constitution was intended to deal with. In general, this is the problem of establishing, defining, and limiting government power. The American Constitution is not a traditional, prescriptive, customary constitution. In political science language, our constitutions in this country are written constitutions rather than unwritten constitutions. This may be an Enlightenment conceit, but if it is, it is still a well-established conceit. The U.S. Constitution is a constructed thing. It is made. It is an artifice. Many years ago, and in some ways now still, it is regarded as a contract or a compact. It figures largely in contractarian thinking. It is the kind of thing about which one can reasonably ask whether it will last or survive, meaning, will it be followed, adhered to, used, or will it be broken down, abandoned, set aside? Architectural imagery has often been used to describe the Constitution in this sense. The idea of a prescriptive Constitution, in contrast, has indefinable or less clearly definable features. A prescriptive Constitution is not an artifice. It is customary, adaptive. It is more likely to be described as a natural, organic, and living thing. American constitutionalism, in my view, does not, in primary and decisive respects, conform to the idea of a prescriptive, organic constitution. So I think the question of survival of the Constitution is an apt question. But is this the right question, whether the Constitution will survive the 21st century? When I spoke about this with my friends, nearly everyone said, that's the wrong question. Has the Constitution survived the 20th century? Does the Clinton impeachment show, most recently, that the Constitution has been strengthened as the only higher ground to which the parties could successfully appeal, as James Caesar wrote in The Standard? Or, alternatively, has the Constitution been shown to be a low, devalued, and insubstantial ground for healthy, consent-based Republican politics? Political life is unpredictable, so in these remarks I will not try to track the trajectory of a series of constitutional trends, such as judicial activism or supremacy, executive centralism, states' rights, administrative state. I won't try to track those particular trends. I do want to offer some reflections on the nature and present tendency of American constitutionalism. I emphasize at the outset two related issues in discussing survival of the Constitution. First, how do you define what the Constitution is in a formal institutional design and procedural sense? Secondly, what is the Constitution for? What ends, objects, and purposes is it supposed to promote? In my view, the Constitution is a written fundamental law that limits government. And in the fundamental law, there is design, there are procedures, and so forth, sometimes quite elaborate and difficult to understand or to follow. Secondly, the purpose of the Constitution is to secure responsible individual liberty and social freedom. Now, the question of the Constitution's survival is not merely an academic political science question, and certainly not merely a jurisprudential question to be thrashed out or hashed out in the academic law schools. It is a practical political issue. It affects how power is exercised and the ends to which power is exercised. For practical reasons, not to go into philosophical issues, it seems to be necessary at the outset to consider the existing political and governmental order as legitimate. But that doesn't mean you have to accept every feature of the existing order, every feature of the constitutional order, as legitimate in a categorical and absolute way. That's the reference was made to the First Things Symposium 3 or 4 years ago, and there was a lot of misunderstanding about that, I think. Whether the Constitution survives and exists is a matter of degree. It is a question that is subject to political judgment, and it is controversial, especially when considered from a point of view internal to the constitutional order. In the American political tradition, to ask whether institutions and acts of government are legitimate is to ask whether they conform to the ends, principles, forms, and procedural requirements stated in the Constitution. This question is never settled conclusively. It must always arise in the course of political life. This, however, is what enforcing or upholding the Constitution means. And we talk about those who take the Constitution seriously, and when we refer to those people, we think it means keeping the Constitution, its requirements, and ends and purposes in the forefront of political thought and action. The problem, however, is that not everyone takes the Constitution seriously in this sense. Some pretend to do so while using the Constitution as a pretext for partisan and ideological action. Enforcement and preservation of the Constitution therefore requires judgment and practical reason, guided by knowledge of what the Constitution is and conviction about what it is for. The Clinton impeachment shows that sometimes in American politics it's necessary to talk about the Constitution, and at such time constitutional talk is cheap. A contributory explanation of this fact is that people are often confused when they talk about the Constitution because there is ambiguity in the concept of a Constitution. Political conflicts that implicate the Constitution give rise to arguments about what the Constitution means. This develops into constitutional law. In these debates, everyone acts as though the Constitution has a real substantive meaning, even though some of the people are using the Constitution as a pretext for partisan and ideological purposes. There is, however, another dimension of constitutional controversies in which the written Constitution is seen to be an expression of the traditions, principles, moral standards, conventions, and ways of life that constitute a people's existence. Russell Kirk, in Roots of American Order, says the written Constitution was an expression of the, in his words, underlying unwritten constitution. James Caesar, in his Standard article, uses the same idea in saying that the Clinton impeachment, in the Clinton impeachment, what is ultimately at stake is the, in Jim's words, moral constitution of the country. He means the unwritten standards of right and wrong carried in the hearts and minds of the American people. This kind of reference to the moral constitution is where, I guess I'd say, the prescriptive idea of a constitution comes back in. It may be impossible to keep it out, even though it's not the primary feature. In a practical sense, in American politics, debate over the forms, the procedures, the ends and objects of the Constitution is what constitutional controversy usually is taken to mean. When we talk about a constitutional controversy, we're not in the primary sense talking about the underlying norms and moral character of the country. A convention exists by which conflict over these deep moral norms is transposed into controversy over the principles, forms, and procedures of the Constitution as fundamental written law. Peaceful contests in forms of constitutional law and politics serve as a surrogate for deeper and more inclusive cultural, social, and moral conflict. It's often thought that this is a safer, healthier, more peaceful way to go about settling controversies over moral standards. There are winners and losers in these less inclusive, more superficial conflicts in constitutional law and politics. The outcome of these contests may have a bearing on underlying moral and cultural issues, but it's impossible to say what impact and what bearing they will have. It makes more sense, in my view, to talk about constitutional controversies at what I call a middle level of significance, in between technical constitutional law on the one hand and what you might call philosophical criticism and discussion of ultimate moral and social norms. Consider a recent episode in constitutional enforcement, the impeachment of President Clinton. Most observers, including Senate Democrats, conceded that Clinton was guilty of a criminal offense, but there was an unwillingness to follow through with the constitutionally prescribed step of removal from office. The Senate chose to save Clinton. Why did it do so? One answer is that Democrats and many Republicans saw a need and an opportunity to save, defend and save the regime, as it's been called here, and was in my text also, the regime of welfare, statist liberalism, by protecting Clinton from defeat at the hands of the Republican majority in Congress. In this view, partisans of the regulatory welfare state, in the name of bipartisanship, acted for the sake of a vision, I would not call it a reality at all, but a vision of social justice imposed by a centralized command system, which undermines individual liberty and social freedom. But another reason for saving Clinton is that Democrats and Republicans together believed that the public opinion polls allowed them to do so. And they wanted to be on the right side of public opinion. They apparently thought being on the side of public opinion gave their action legitimacy, irrespective of the Constitution. And they therefore disregarded their constitutional duty to follow the constitutionally prescribed step of removal of the president from office on a demonstration of guilt. The Republicans argued that conviction and removal were required to uphold the rule of law. They seemed to think that if you just said rule of law is at stake, people would say, oh, I didn't understand that, now I do, therefore we'll change our mind. Democrats defended privacy and presidential sex as a way of protecting the liberties of the people, and I kid you not, read the impeachment testimony of Cass Sunstein and other luminaries. Does the outcome of this impeachment trial mean that the winning side had a superior constitutional argument, let alone the superior moral argument? Does the outcome influence the deeper moral cultural issues at stake? This raises the general question of what winning and losing a constitutional controversy means. What practical significance does it have? Well, I will say here that you can lose the constitutional struggle and say, well, we tried, we got a fair shot at it, it proves the Constitution works, and let's move on. On the other hand, you can say the other side is wrong, and you can question the winner's construction of the Constitution as a sound construction. But if the losers keep losing additional constitutional controversies, it seems to me necessary for them to do something about it for the sake of maintaining the Constitution as fundamental law. If the losers don't do anything, their inaction will be taken as acceptance of the legitimacy of the government measures in question. At a superficial level, the winners in a constitutional conflict, by definition, have the better argument, until it's proved otherwise by the losers getting out there and doing something about it. If the Constitution has been violated, it's the losers who bear responsibility for doing something about it, if they really believe it has been violated. Now, since the New Deal, limited government has not been positively valued in American politics and law, as I need not tell you. The New Dealers tried to justify the constitutional, the political revolution of the New Deal, the government revolution, by saying it was consistent with the framers' understanding of things like the Commerce Clause. But later, when the conservatives began to say that the New Deal was unconstitutional, and when some conservative politicians began to act on that premise and that understanding, then the liberals changed their mind. Then they made up a new theory that, this is an important point, the new liberal theory rejects constitutional continuity and appeals to revolutionary discontinuity as a means of constitutional change and legitimacy. I think this means that the liberals are leaving the problem of constitutional continuity and enforcement to the conservatives, and many conservatives have picked up original intent jurisprudence as a way of carrying through the problem of constitutional enforcement. But I emphasize that during the Clinton administration, the Democrats, with remarkable candor, have violated and otherwise disregarded the Constitution, and they simply are daring the Republicans to do something about it. Now, what this boils down to is whether the Constitution will survive if it is enforced. Raise the question of how you enforce a constitution. And this enforcement goes to rule enforcement. It's not it doesn't seem like a very high moral purpose to enforce rules. I know that rule enforcement is not what Kantian morality is all about, but on the other hand, we don't have to be Kantian moralists, I suppose. But the key to constitutional enforcement is getting citizens to engage in a coordination effort where they can agree on what the government should do. And then they should bring pressure to bear on the government so the government understands that consent is not just a theoretic thing, but consent can be withdrawn. And in a consent-based regime, you have to emphasize and show that consent can be withdrawn. Citizen groups also need the assistance of elites, who also have motives and purposes that differ among themselves. Coordination efforts to enforce constitutional rules is hard because citizens have different social circumstances and economic circumstances. They can be bought off by government in all kinds of rent-seeking arrangements. And so it's very hard for citizens to agree. A major coordination effort. Same thing for the elites. That's why it's particularly distressing for political elites in the Republican Party to take such an abject view as they did during the impeachment trial. One of the themes here is that constitutional enforcement is not mainly a judicial thing. It's a political thing. It goes to political action, political understanding, and the talking about the nature of the regime reinforces this political character of constitutional enforcement. Now, I will conclude by saying that this kind of recent episode, the Clinton impeachment, and other things like the war in Yugoslavia, the U.S.-NATO war, and even lower level things like having an assistant attorney general for civil rights who has not been put through the mill in the Senate. You see, these are lower level things, but they all have practical significance for the survival of the Constitution. Simply stated, if these things keep happening, the Constitution will not survive. Now, you can't expect the people who run the government to enforce the rules that are set up to keep them limited. They're not going to do it. They don't have the incentives, or they have the wrong incentives. Old things like oath of office, duty, veneration of the rule of law don't work. Citizen and elite outsiders, that is outside the ruling coalition, the ruling administration, these citizen and elite outsiders have to enforce the Constitution if it's going to be preserved. You might say they have a duty to do so. But do they have the necessary incentive? I think the design of the Constitution is sound, and it has plenty of incentives in it, the kind that are needed to make fundamental law effective, so that it's not just a parchment barrier, to use Madison's language, but it's a real barrier against ambitious and corrupt rulers. The Constitution will survive if necessary resources of intellect, will, conviction, and political judgment are marshaled in a coordinated effort to defend and maintain it. Will this preserve or restore the unwritten moral constitution of the country? That's debatable, but at least enforcing the Constitution is a step in the right direction. Limiting government is a worthy choice as a course of political action, while the work of rebuilding moral foundation, moral formation in our youth, goes on. And thank you very much.